Welcome to The Artist's Creed. I'm Steve Guthrie, professor of theology and the arts at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. The Artist's Creed is a conversation about Christianity, creativity, and the arts. And the venue we've chosen for that conversation is the Apostles' Creed, an expression of the Christian faith with roots in the worship and proclamation of the early church. The Apostles' Creed begins with the words, "I believe," and the creed itself has its beginnings as the profession of faith that Christians would make at their baptism. So it's easy to think that what I believe is among the most personal, the most private things about myself. But of course, when I repeat the words of the creed, I'm not just saying what I believe. I'm repeating words that I've inherited from others. That doesn't mean, however, that they aren't my words as well. For generations, Christians have found their own voices by repeating the words of others. This is one of the beautiful paradoxes of the creed. Here, I announce what I believe, and here, I enter into and share in the words of others. So we find ourselves in community. In repeating the creed, we learn a distinctive language, the church's own lexicon of faith. Because the words of the creed are ancient words, and because they're words set out in a formal structure, the act of reciting them has sometimes been dismissed as sterile and dead. We might say just the opposite, however. Because these words have been cultivated in community, because they've been inhabited by countless believers over the centuries, they're profoundly alive, in the same way that a building filled with people is more alive than a solitary structure meant for a single inhabitant. When we learn this language and share these words, we're connected to a great communion of saints. The creed also tells a story. In its first article, it speaks of creation, and then it goes on to move through the story of Jesus' life, and then into the life of the church and the consummation of all things. So part of what's happening when we say, "I believe," is we are entering into and finding ourselves within the story that the creed tells. In this episode, I'll be talking with Dr. Kirsten Jeffrey Johnson, who is a recognized expert on the thought and work of George MacDonald. We don't talk about the creed explicitly in this episode, but a lot of the themes that I've mentioned come up in our conversation. We talk about how, for MacDonald, we find our voices in conversation with others, not by setting ourselves off from others. Dr. Jeffrey Johnson also talks about the ways in which we are made, unmade, and remade by stories, and the ways in which language and story creates and connects us to community. I mentioned to you when I asked you to join me that I don't know a ton of stuff about George MacDonald, and nevertheless, you're still my friend, right?
I'm holding out. Yeah. Hope in the future.
So I thought it would be good maybe just to provide a little bit of background information about George MacDonald, yeah? A few well-known facts. He is raised in the Highlands of Scotland, yeah, in a very strict, dour, Calvinist family, and he ends up kind of rejecting all of that very forcefully.
So when do I pop in and tell you that you're now reiterating the received myth?
That's right. That's your cue. Please correct my myth. So that's myth number one. Tell me why that's incorrect. Although I will say, so you sent me this list of myths about George MacDonald, but that is, I think, what I understood to be the case about George MacDonald before you corrected that. So that's not the truth. Is that right?
No, and it's what I understood to be the case even my first few years in as on MacDonald scholar.
Wow.
It is what most of the biographies, like many of the myths or received truths, and I use the word, actually, I want to go back and seeing as we're talking about MacDonald, I should honor MacDonald and Lewis and Tolkien and not call these myths necessarily, but...
Yeah, I was just about to say, that's...
Misconceptions.
These are bad myths, right? Not the good myths.
Yeah, the common misconceptions about McDonald's that even many McDonald's scholars, let alone other Inklings scholars, still hold today.
I understood that most of his life he was a preacher, but because of his sort of radical and unconventional views... He was cast off by his congregation and then spent the rest of his life trying to support his family as a writer. But that's not the case, you say, yeah?
No, and that's not the case. And again, this is, you know, this is something that I myself believed to be the case, even when I was first giving lectures and writing papers on McDonald.
Huh.
But the more primary research I did on McDonald, the more this was thrown into question, which was actually kind of a relief for me because... Some of these misconceptions about McDonald just didn't really jive with what he was writing.
Huh.
And it was quite a few years for me before I finally stopped and I started doing some math. As I jotted down McDonald's timeline, I looked, McDonald was a minister for 29 months.
Huh.
For 29 months in his early 20s, he was a paid minister. Against his father's advice, his father encouraged him to be a teacher. He thought that that was McDonald's biggest gifting, that literature and teaching literature was where he should be. McDonald goes to seminary and he becomes a minister, but even as he does so, he's writing to his siblings and he's writing to his family saying, I'm going to do this for a time, but what I really want to do is write. That's what I really want to do. And McDonald, he really gels with some people in his congregation. He does not gel with others. Some people do not like what he is preaching from the pulpit.
Sure.
And rather than being kicked out, what happens is some of the influential people in the congregation start lowering his salary.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, being a young dad with a growing family, that combined with his own passion for literature, both teaching and writing it, kind of contribute to McDonald's decision to withdraw. And after those 29 months, so one more time, 29 months as a minister, as a clergy, McDonald goes on to spend the next 40 years of his life lecturing and teaching literature. He was an English literature professor officially in colleges, universities for 10 years, but he gave public lectures specifically on British literature and Dante for the next 40 years of his life.
Yeah.
He continues to guest preach, and he's in high demand as a guest preacher, and he's offered numerous pulpits through the rest of his life, but he always turns them down.
Yeah.
And he always refuses to be paid for preaching because his occupation and his vocation is story and calling people to story.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Again, so a very different picture of McDonald than what I had, which was somebody who was a minister off, you know, in the croft somewhere in the Highlands writing by himself. And not a literature professor.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you talk about in one of your recent lectures is that George MacDonald, and you say that he's in this way very much like his mentors, Scott and F.D. Morris, he's deeply committed to social reform.
Yes.
And then you go on to say, and here I quote you. Is it exciting to you if I'm quoting you? Here's a quote.
Worrisome.
Here's a quote from Kirsten Jeffrey Johnson. Quote, they passionately believed that the most powerful tool for effecting this social reform was the medium of story. So that, again, that's kind of surprising and interesting. So MacDonald and some of his contemporaries believed that social reform might come about through story. In what way might story be an engine for social reform in MacDonald's mind? You know?
Oh, if I can tell a little bit of a story.
Yeah, absolutely.
MacDonald's primary mentor, intellectual and theological mentor, was a man named Alexander John Scott, A.J. Scott. And Scott was a Scottish minister and teacher who came down to England in his young adulthood and was really, really surprised at how little story was valued and shared in England. When Scott comes down to England, we're right smack dab in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. Mm. And so people are coming from the country, from rural Britain, congregating in urban sprawl, and they're being ripped out of the communities. So they're losing their family stories. They're losing their folk tales or cultural stories. Sense of identity is really shaken up in the Industrial Revolution. Family structure isn't existing in the same way in the cities like it did in the countries. People even losing touch with their parishes or church communities. So they're losing the stories of their churches as well as the stories told in their churches.
Yeah.
And they feel that this lack of story is especially disconcerting because they feel to better understand who we are in relation to God, we need to know who we are.
Yeah.
And if we don't know our stories, then we don't have a full understanding of who we are in relation to God or in relation to each other, whether that's the people around us or the countries beside us.
Wow. So this telling these old stories is part of their response to this kind of social dislocation, yeah, that you're talking about with the Industrial Revolution, people displaced from their communities. And part of the response is these people need to know their stories. They need to know where they've come from. They need to know kind of this history of shared narrative. Yeah, is that?
But yes, and knowing our stories can be disconcerting because it reminds us that we are all human. It reminds us of the things we share as well as our differences. It reminds us that we can learn from those who are different from us, that men can learn from women, that poor can learn from rich, that mentally or physically disabled can teach those who are physically and mentally abled things that they do not know, that revelation does not come from just knowledge or intelligence, but that love and wisdom can teach much that education cannot. These things all come through the stories of our history, the biblical stories, our community stories, the stories in literature.
Yeah.
And this is what begins to incur social reform.
Yeah. Well, that's really helpful too when you say that stories can be really troubling or unsettling. Because I think at first, as we're talking about that, I'm just thinking of kind of stories giving us a sense of place and being connected. But also, I mean, in terms of contemporary events, you know, in America, a lot of people are pointing out the ways in which we don't want to tell the stories of racism. We don't want to tell the stories of discrimination. We don't want to hear those parts of our own history. So that stories, like you said, often help us by unsettling us, not just kind of bedtime stories that sort of comfort us.
And both Scott and McDonald will hasten to point out that knowing the stories of our history, whether that's the history of our churches or of our families or of our culture, would remind us that we're all immigrants, except for the First Nations people, and that we all were strangers once. And you know, knowing our own stories actually reminds us who we really are, rather than our current self-retold narrative.
Yeah, well, that's
which is
good.
Part of why we also need to read story in community, so we don't make up our own current story, but we're rooted in the truth of the past.
Yeah, that's good. I'd like to talk a little bit about fantasties. Am I saying that right, by the way? Fantasties?
Most people say fantasties, but
well, I want to be like most people.
People wrestle over it.
No, I want to be like most people. I'm going to say fantasties from now on, all the rest of my life. And when I do, I'll think of you and this moment.
Like fantastic.
Okay, I've got it now. So I was really glad You gave a lecture on this recently, and you sent me the text of that, which I found really helpful. I will tell you, Kirsten, my first encounter with MacDonald was through Phantastes and Lilith. I think I was,
oh,
I was,
no.
I was 19 years old, and I read somewhere. I read somewhere, yeah, that C.S. Lewis, you know, said that George MacDonald was his master and that he had influenced everything that he ever did. And I thought, oh, I need to read some George MacDonald. So as a 19-year-old, I went out and I got a copy of Lilith and read that and thought, what just happened? You know, that was weird. And then I read Phantastes and didn't understand it either. But I'm going to, I think you mentioned that a lot of people, not just 19-year-olds, but MacDonald scholars find those works bewildering. But I loved the way you walked through that story in your lecture. And you suggest there, well, a couple of things. There's the main character who in many ways is somebody who is reformed by reading stories. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that one of the central themes of the novel is servanthood. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Can I read a passage that you quote from Phantastes, and maybe we can talk about
that? Yes, please do.
So, no man could rise to the honor of knighthood without service. A nobleman's son even had to wait on his father, or to go into the family of another nobleman and wait upon him as a page, standing behind his chair at dinner. This was an honor. No notion of degradation was in it. It was a necessary step to higher honor. And what was the next higher honor? To be set free from service? No, to serve in the harder service of the field, to be a squire to some noble knight, to tend his horse, to clean his armor, to see that every rivet was sound, every buckle true, every strap strong, to ride behind him and carry his spear, and if more than one attacked him, to rush to his aid. This service was the more honorable because it was harder and was the next step to higher honor yet. And what was this higher honor? That of knighthood. Wherein did this knighthood consist? The very word simply means service. And for what was the knight thus waited on upon by his squire? That he might be free to do as he pleased? No, but that he might be free to be the servant of all. By being a squire first, the servant of one, he learned to rise to the higher rank, that of servant of all.
The Artist's Creed is hosted by the Rabbit Room Podcast Network in cooperation with the College of Theology and Christian Ministry at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. Belmont University is a student-centered Christian community providing an academically challenging education that empowers men and women of diverse backgrounds to engage and transform the world with disciplined intelligence, compassion, courage, and faith. Belmont offers dozens of engaging and innovative programs, including a major in religion and the arts. Find out more at belmont.edu/theology. Significant support, including generous access to recording facilities, has also been provided by Lipscomb University. Learn more at lipscomb.edu. And now, back to our podcast.
So that's really powerful.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So the main character, if I'm right, and then you can correct me or elaborate on this, he discovers the nature of true knighthood through encountering the literature of knighthood and chivalry. Is that right?
Yes, and through, and this is a key theme throughout MacDonald, through not just reading the stories, so that is very, very important, and he talks about how when he reads the stories, he enters the tales, and he himself is transformed. He says he's like he's died and risen again within the stories. He's become a new person because of the adventures. He joins the protagonist in partaking in those stories. So when he comes out, he's got a whole new view in the world. But what's really key throughout MacDonald is then he has to learn to put that into practice.
Yeah.
Can't just be caught up in the nobility of thought, but he has to learn how to put nobility of thought into nobility of deed.
Yeah.
And this is part of what the character has to learn again and again in different ways throughout the story of Fantastes. And the quotation that you read is actually, MacDonald writes a couple different versions of that passage in different writings. And that is actually, he writes that after he's finished writing Fantastes, but it really is a summary of what happens in Fantastes. This young man who's 20, is his 21st birthday, he's about to be put in charge of the entire estate, his sisters, all the people working on the farm, and he's completely captivated with the concept of chivalry, to be a young chivalric English gentleman. And he's caught up with the idea of romances, and he wants to be a knight in shining armor. And then all of a sudden, he wakes up and finds himself in fairyland and discovers that being a knight in shining armor isn't, you know, dashing in, rescuing the maiden, and getting the glory. He's actually forced back into the actual definition of the old English word knight, knight, which means one who serves. And he has to figure out what that means and learn to serve, to be the servant of all, even if they aren't a beautiful, rich young maiden needing rescuing. In fact, throughout the story, he is rescued again and again himself by women, by peasants. And he has to learn that part of service is accepting being served as well, which is sometimes even harder than serving.
That's really interesting, because there's kind of a an unstorying as well as a restorying, right?
So absolutely, that's brilliant.
So he has a false story of knighthood and a false story of chivalry that then has to be restoried.
Brilliant.
That's really good. And then,
and to do that restoring, MacDonald draws upon hundreds of stories throughout English literature, German fairy tales, French fairy tales. He draws upon other stories within Fantastes very explicitly at times and very subtly at other times to shape his story of this character being restoried.
That's, and that connects to another thing that that I wanted to ask you about that I found really interesting. You say that as a writer and a storyteller, George MacDonald is very deliberately and even very explicitly dependent on others, right? He wants to make clear all the ways in which he's drawing on other writers, all the ways in which he is in dialogue with other writers. And I found that so interesting because I mentioned this to you earlier. I spoke recently about a competitive vision of artistry, which is, I think, characteristic of the modern era, versus a non-competitive vision of artistry. And a competitive vision of artistry says that we are creative just to the extent that we are untouched by the influence of others. So we describe, you know, great works of art as groundbreaking or unprecedented, you know, revolutionary. But that's not very satisfying from a Christian perspective, that, you know, that we might be more creative the more we're isolated from others. But and it seems as if you're saying in some of your lectures that MacDonald has a very different conception of creativity, and that creativity is a matter of kind of entering into conversation with others and hearing lots of other voices.
I think it ties back to MacDonald's theology. MacDonald is a Trinitarian Christian who believes God is relationship embodied, and he is constantly calling us into relationship with him. And into relationship with others. It is not good for man to be alone. Love the Lord thy God. Love your neighbor as yourself. This is the very crux, quite literally, of our faith, is being in relationship. And for MacDonald, this spills out into everything. And he would say to the futurists and the modernists who say that we can create uniquely, not only is that a very un-Christian perspective, you'd say it's a psychologically self-deceiving perspective, because we are a part of all that we have met. and it is impossible for a human to live in isolation, to exist in isolation. We have engaged with our family, with our community, the people around us. We see creation around us, the animals, the plants, the birds. And the more aware we are of God, there is God engaging with us. So we're constantly surrounded by community, whether we choose to intentionally engage with it or not. And McDonald believes that the more attentive we are, the more intentional we are at engaging with that community, the more we will understand who God is, the more self-aware in a healthy way we will become, and the more, the greater our grasp of truth, because if God is relational, a relational being, ultimate truth is in communicating with others and relating with others. When it comes to literature, McDonald's, he practices an inheritance of participation, if you will. He engages with the long conversation. He goes back and he sees how even writers of scripture are responding to engaging with literature that comes before scripture. But the whole Christian heritage, inheritance of literature is writers looking back and engaging with scripture, and then the writers after them looking back and engaging with them. McDonald talks about the about literature being an antiphonal expression. It's this chorus of voices responding to voices, and he urges, particularly as Christians, that when reading literature, we look for the cross-sections of shared truths, of shared themes, of shared ideas, and we engage with those things that we see ringing true in multiple voices through the ages, across the ages.
So it really is a conversation, right? So it's not just that that we have to make sure that we are sort of slavishly repeating all the stories that we've received, but there really is a dialogue that we receive these stories and we add our voices to those stories and we enrich them in that way. And in some instances, we want to critique those stories, right? Where we
absolutely, because it's a conversation.
Yeah, no, that's really good. And
McDonald doesn't 100% agree with Dante.
Yeah.
He doesn't 100% agree with Plato. He doesn't 100% agree with John Bunyan. But there are things with which he does agree and with about which he's very excited. And the things with which he disagrees, he thinks it's important to engage and discuss and tease those things out.
Yeah.
But to do so respectfully, too. McDonald proffers his readers a kind of challenging way of looking at this long conversation that we're having and this engagement with readers through the past and even the responsibility we have towards reading them well and critiquing them well and critiquing them hospitably. He encourages us not just to be inhospitable in our conversation with those around us, but in our reading of people, whether they are living contemporaries or people of the past. But he actually pushes that a little further because he encourages us to think
eschatologically.
Yes. He encourages us to think eschatologically about the people, about the authors whom we are reading and engaging with. He reminds us that not only are you having a chance to engage with what Bunyan says here, what Dante says here, and a chance to agree with them, to disagree with them, to push back a little bit, but remember that you'll have a chance to engage with them in the future. These are not just our friends on our shelf with whom we can engage in our heads, but we don't get the satisfaction of hearing their voice back to our pushback or our excitement at what they've written. But actually, someday, you're going to be able to stand there and talk to John Bunyan. You're going to be able to stand there and talk to Dante.
Yeah, that's Well, actually, can I read a quote that you sent me? I thought this was a really interesting idea. And then you can pick up on that idea out of this quote. So you sent me a quotation from A Dish of Orts. Is that right?
Yes.
Next to possessing a true, wise, and victorious friend seated by your fireside, it is blessed to have the spirit of such a friend embodied, for spirit can assume any embodiment, on your bookshelves. But in the latter case, the friendship is all on one side. For full friendship, your friend must love you and know that you love him. Surely these biographies are not merely spiritual links connecting us in the truest manner with past times and vanished minds, and thus producing strong half-friendships. Are they not likewise links connecting us with a future, wherein these souls shall dawn upon ours, rising again from the death of the past into the life of our knowledge and love? Are not these biographies letters of introduction, forwarded, but not yet followed by him whom they introduce, for whose step we listen and whose voice we long to hear, and whom we shall yet meet somewhere in the infinite? Shall I not one day, somewhere, somehow, clasp the large hand of Novalis, and gazing on his face, compare his features with those of St. John? Man, I loved that quote. So
exciting.
And it's really an interesting idea, right? Especially, you mentioned the communion of the saints, which part of that idea is that when we talk about being part of the body of Christ, we're saying that we are connected to a body that extends not only around the world, but across time. So that there is this this great cloud of witnesses that's gone before us with whom we are one body as well, right? So he's, and it's an interesting line of reasoning he follows too, that when you read a book, you're in conversation with it, but maybe it seems like that's just a one-sided conversation, but he says, no, maybe someday you're going to be able to complete that conversation, that there's a kind of eschatological dimension to it, as you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, is that?
Yeah, and which is, it's exciting to think about, it's humbling, especially for literary critics to think about.
Yeah.
But it also can sort of blow open your reading and your thinking about reading in a whole new way. And for MacDonald, this is one of the things he wants to do throughout all his books, whether all his writings, whether it's sermons or poems or fantasy or realistic novels, is he sees one of the roles of these things he writes as introductions. He is eager, truly eager, to introduce his readers to these friends, to these other voices. And for him, it's not just introducing an idea on a page. It's introducing a living person.
Wow, that's really interesting.
And in his theology, a living person that you and I may actually have an opportunity to meet ourselves someday.
Yeah, amazing. I have one short quote that I wanted to ask you about just before I let you go. You alluded to this before when we were talking about fantasies, and is it Anados? How do you say his name?
Anados, which Anados has two meanings in Greek. It means both without a way, which is how he starts out the novel.
Oh, yeah, Anhados.
But it can also be read to mean the way up. And that's who he becomes by the end of the novel.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that it was key to his transformation, not just that he read about chivalry and knighthood, but that he live it, that he enact it. And then you quote this this passage from the end of the story where when Anados returns to his estate, he returns to his own time. And he says, "I began the duties of my new position, somewhat instructed, I hoped, by the adventures that had befallen me in fairyland. Could I translate the experience of my travels there into common life here?" So that's a powerful question. So when we talk about the transformational power of stories, and when we talk about MacDonald and his contemporaries wanting to bring about social reform through stories, can that happen? In what way can that happen? What would MacDonald say? Is it possible for those stories, that those ideas we encounter there in fairyland, to make a difference to our lives here?
Only in community,
holding
each other accountable, retelling the stories, sharing the stories. But can it happen? It happened to Paul. It happened to John Wesley. It happened to T.S. Eliot.
Yeah.
It's happened to you and to I that we have been changed in little ways and in big ways by the gospel stories we've read and by other stories we've read. It happened to King Theoden when he first met Ents, but then many readers of Middle Earth, when they now see trees are no longer just boring trees because of having journeyed through Middle Earth.
Yeah.
For many readers of Narnia, thanks to Lucy realizing that that is just what a star is made of, but not what a star is, we now see stars in different ways.
Hmm.
Those are minor transformations. Of course, the gospel itself, the gospel story, has the potential within it to do the most major of transformations.
Yeah.
But all stories, MacDonald would say, as embodiments of relationship, have the power to change because we are changed through relationship.
Mm. Yeah.
That is the Shema, right?
Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one.
If you carry on in Deuteronomy, when the Israelites are called to hear, O Israel, know the Lord thy God is one God. And how do you do this?
Mm.
The passage goes on to say, you do this by telling the stories at the table, telling the stories as you walk down the road, telling the stories to your children. This, in its fullness, is the Shema, telling the stories of our stories of our relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
That is how we hear the Lord, how we love the Lord, how we love each other.
Yeah.
By engaging intentionally with story together. And I think what I hear you saying is we've lost that intentionality.
Hmm.
We still do have stories there, but I think particularly as Christians, we are specifically called to be intentional about engaging with story together.
Yeah.
And there in that spot, the greatest transformation is going to happen.
It reminds me of that very famous passage from Lewis's experiment in criticism, that in encountering great literature, I see with 1,000 eyes and yet remain myself.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yet, and not only that, but become even more myself for seeing through those 1,000 eyes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, good. So there's the non-competitive piece as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
That in community, our self isn't swallowed up, but we become more fully ourselves.
Yeah. And we either choose to be more honest or we're forced to be more honest about the fact that we have not made ourselves, but we have been made by another who is calling us into communion with others.
Thanks for listening to this first episode of The Artist's Creed with Steve Guthrie. Before we wrap up this episode, Steve is going to read an excerpt from one of his very favorite theologians, Karl Barth, about the phrase, I believe, in the Apostles' Creed, and what that means for us. If you're interested in more episodes of The Artist's Creed and more great podcasts, visit rabbitroom.com/podcast.
Barth's Dogmatics in Outline begins with, after an introductory chapter, three chapters where he talks about the two little words, I believe, or what is the character of faith. The third of those chapters is called Faith as Confession. And again, this picks up on some of the things that we talked about in our conversation today. The idea that even our most personal pronouncements, when I stand up and say, I believe, for instance, I am using language that I've inherited from others. And so that when we say we believe, we're entering into a language and a story that has been prepared for us by the community of faith. So I'm going to read a little bit from that chapter, beginning on page 30. In faith, we have the freedom to be publicly responsible in the language of the church, for our trust and our knowledge. What does this mean? God's congregation possessed and at all times possesses its own language. Nothing can change this, for it has in history its own special history, its own special road. It speaks when it confesses in relation to this special history. It stands in the quite special concrete historical context, which has at all times formed its language and will continue to form it. Therefore, the language of faith, the language of public responsibility, in which Christians we are bound to speak, will inevitably be the language of the Bible, the Hebrew and the Greek Bible and the translations of them, and the language of Christian tradition, the language in the forms of the thoughts, concepts, and ideas in which the course of centuries the Christian church gained and upheld and declared its knowledge. There is a specifically church language that is in order. Let us call it by the familiar name by saying that there is a language of Canaan. And when the Christian confesses his faith, when we have to let the light that is kindled in us shine, no one can avoid speaking in this language. For this is how it is. If the things of Christian faith, if our trust in God and his word is to be expressed precisely, so to speak, in its essence, and time and again, it is bitterly necessary for this to be done, so that things may be made clear, then it is inevitable that all undaunted, the language of Canaan should sound forth.
Thanks for listening to The Artist's Creed. This episode was brought to you by The Rabbit Room, a Nashville-based nonprofit that seeks to foster Christ-centered community and spiritual formation through music, story, and art. You can learn more at rabbitroom.com.